this is Mary J. Blige.
I'm Nicki Minaj.
What's up? This is Jay-Z.
From London, England and Washington, D.C., you are now tuned in to Conversations with Allison J. The Journey to Here, brought to you by Ethel May Books. This is Conversations with Allison J. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Allison J., The Journey to Here. Today, as always, we have another captivating and thought-provoking topic and guest. Here's your host, Allison J.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Allison J. I'm your host, Allison J. Today, I would like to welcome our guest, Yvonne Jean. Yvonne is the author of Dreaming of a Life Unlived. As a woman of color, Yvonne knows only too well the experience of being silenced to the point of being too ashamed to say that I am childless. But Yvonne now celebrates the woman that she has become through the power of owning her story, through her book, Dreaming of a Life Unlived, which is a collection of stories of women who have bravely documented their experiences, charting their journeys through grief to reclaiming their joy and finding a fulfilling life without children. Yvonne also supports World Childless Week as a woman who is childless, not by choice. Yvonne, thank you for joining us here on Conversations with Allison J. Welcome. It is my pleasure to have you.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be here.
Great. Thank you so much. Yvonne, as we've had, we've spoken previously, I'm really interested and wanting to know your journey, your path to today, and being able to overcome, to really be, as you've said, to reclaiming and just loving the woman that you are today. Because we know through society, through culture, and even our own internal pressures, what it's like to have that stigma and, dare I even say the word, shame of not having children and being able to, because I don't think you ever fully come through that, because the desire will always be there, because I don't think it's something that you can say, you know, I wanted children and then all of a sudden I don't want them anymore. But to be able to get past all the pressures that are put on culturally, from society and internally, to be able to say, you know something, I can reclaim the joy in my life. So Yvonne, share with us your story, please, your journey.
Oh, my journey has been such an interesting one. There's been so many twists and turns. Oh my God, it's like a roller coaster ride. So, I mean, in a way, whenever I get asked this question, I never know when to start, but I always really start from October 2014, because in October 2014, I remember sitting in front of a consultant. I had fertility investigations for a whole year, and at that point, I was at the end of that part of my journey, and I sat in front of this fertility consultant who told me I had unexplained infertility. I had never heard this term before.
Okay.
And I remember just pretty much blinking at him, thinking, what the hell are you talking about? And part of what he was saying was, you know, there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with your husband. You know, keep trying. You can try IVF, but, you know, I'm releasing you back to your GP. I suggest you keep trying. And again, I sat there going, huh? None of this made any sense. But I knew, it was one of those moments where I knew in my heart that I would never become a mum. I would never give birth to my own child. So in that, I think I left the office. I think I was due to go back to work, if I remember rightly, but I couldn't go in. I remember going home and just collapsing on my bed and burst out crying, which was a huge surprise for me, because up until that point, I was very ambivalent about becoming a mum. And so to be in that moment in floods of tears was just like a crazy surprise. It made no sense. So just taking you back to how I got to that point, I remember, like, dating in my 20s, and I didn't have the best dating life in my 20s. There's a lot of processing I've done around it, and mm-hmm. and to understand kind of my own experiences.
Many
and
how of I us can identify with that. My both my hands are up, by the way.
I've got feet up as well. This
is... Oh yeah.
<It's> like, you know, and if you know, for me, there were some nice times. I'm not going to say it was all horrible, but. Mm-hmm. I think being a young woman who didn't know who she was,
okay,
therefore entering relationships, always changing myself for whoever I was with, because I didn't understand, as I said, I didn't know who I was, I didn't understand my worth, I didn't value myself enough to be able to be strong in that. And I certainly didn't know how to say no. And that's going to give people a very interesting picture of me. But I didn't. I was afraid, too afraid to say no. And mainly because I felt that guy would leave.
I don't think people think differently of you if they're honest with themselves. Because a lot of us have gone through, and we, because I've mentored teens and boys and girls, and many of them, stayed in situations, and many of them lost their virginity. And this is not just, this is the world over, to a guy because they thought that's what they needed to do to keep them.
This is a good point. This is very true. And I suppose, you know, I'm telling my story unapologetically because that's exactly what my experience was.
Mm.
And, you know, I remember at the time feeling really crap about it and really crap about myself. But looking back, I didn't know any better. And I'm not saying this to criticize anyone in my life, but we grew up, you know, a Caribbean family. We didn't talk about stuff. So there were things, and, you know, my parents definitely wanted to protect me. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that. And I don't hold any bad feelings towards them for that, because I've come to understand the whys. And if you take it back another generation, if their parents didn't teach them, what were they going to teach us? What were they going to instill in us? Exactly. So they did.
I can't stand in front of somebody and go and start teaching algebra. I don't know the first clue about B equals C over X. No, I have no clue.
Yeah.
So of course they couldn't.
No. And, you know, but they did the best they could and with the resources they had.
Yeah.
For me, there was things I needed that I didn't even know at the time. Again, I can look back and I can say, well, this is what I wanted, this is what I needed. But at the time, I couldn't articulate that either. And I think as well, being, and there's going to be a lot of black girls and even black men and women that would hear this and be able to understand, acknowledge and say, yeah, this was their experiences. But we grew up not being seen as individuals, not being seen for who we were in terms of our character and have that develop. We grew up in homes being told we were going to be certain people who they said we were going to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, yes, there was parameters we had to live in. And that was none of that was about exploring who we were or, you know, celebrating us for our individualness and allowing us to go into the world and mm-hmm. find what we wanted to do, you know, and who we wanted to be. So for me, moving on, I remember in my 20s, I then led me to have two terminations. I went into a charismatic church in my late 20s, right through to my mid late 30s. And I really felt crap about myself. You know, I was at a point where I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. I'd walk with my head down. You know, people used to come up to me in the street and say, hold your head up, be proud. And I couldn't do it.
It's a complete stranger to do that.
Yeah.
And I can identify with that, even as much as I was one of those people. I never walked with my head down. I was that person that I was like Moses. As I walked down the street, people parted to let me go through because I walked, you know, straight back, head up, stare the world in the face. However, for me, people would come to me and say, smile, love, it might never happen.
Mm.
Because, and I would be thinking, what? I'm fine.
Until
I caught my reflection one day, Yvonne, and I remember this was, I was in a shop in Bond Street. I remember it very clearly. It was January. I think it was January of 1998. Remember this very clearly. I was going up the escalator and I turned to the left and I saw my reflection in the glass. I nearly fell backwards. The expression on my face was so, I can't even recreate it. Or the only way I could describe it, my face looked contorted. I can't, honestly, I cannot even recreate the look on my face. I remember it so vividly. And I thought, that's what people see. So as much as so we were having the same experience, but even though our posture and our demeanor was different,
yeah,
the same experience. So I can identify with that completely. Yeah.
I mean, it's something I've come to learn, realize now, is that it's very important to have the right people around you, because our bodies show us things that we don't see for ourselves. We don't even feel it inside. So when somebody's kind of identifying something, seeing something in us, know that they're saying it out of care, and you know, they're trying to in a way look after us because they see something. But when you can't connect to that yourself, you can be very dismissive about it and in a way shrug it off and not pay any mind. But I do remember in my late 20s, and I think I was very, very down, very, very down on myself. Mm-hmm. I really hated who I had become in my mind. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, for me, having two terminations, you know, how stupid could you be? That was my inner voice talking.
Right.
You know, getting yourselves into these situations. So I remember turning to church. I went to a charismatic church and I was there for about 10 years because I really wanted to be different. Mm-hmm. I really did. So I had this whole, you know, your sins are washed away, it's all forgotten, you're new now, you know. And I did, I kind of felt like I was starting again, though the slate had been wiped clean. Mm-hmm. So I'd gone through that experience, things happened, and I ended up leaving. And I was then in my mid to late 30s in this place where I just thought I really needed to understand what had happened to me in terms of the church experience I had. Mm-hmm. So I went on this journey of kind of a bit of self-discovery, but not in the same way as I've done it more recently. It was, again, the tools, what I knew to do at the time. Mm-hmm. And I came to this place where I thought, I'm happy with myself. I've made decisions in the past. I did in a way want to be married, but it was probably more about what everyone else said I should be doing. So, you know, growing up hearing when you get married, when you have kids. So I believe a lot of that want and that desire was from other people.
An external pressure. And I do reference this a lot, because a lot of what we go through, if we were to sit down and dissect it and just put it into compartments, what is the internal pressure, the pressure that I am putting on myself? And what is the external pressure coming from society or culture and things like that? And then you start to look at you can start to dissect these pressures and just drop them off.
Do you know, it's really important to look at that. It's the things we have never been taught to do. You know, we became adults because the law said you turn 16, you're an adult now, or 18 and you're an adult. And then there's a different expectation of us. But at no point was there any conversations, any teaching, any learning about how you develop, how you get there. And part of development is actually going inwards, is stripping things back, is questioning the whys and understanding and knowing yourself a bit more. But you will never do that without unpacking.
Right.
Because, you know, you're just sitting there going through life and you think, oh, yeah, I've learned from that. Most of the time it happened and we move on. Mm-hmm. Or so we think. Because we never truly move on in the sense that we believe it's happening. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the language we use, we move on, we get over it, and we get on with our lives. And essentially, we're forgetting. That's what we think we're doing, is we're just forgetting about it and getting on with stuff. So for me, that's truly what I thought had happened. And I was in this place where I thought, well, you know, I was moving into my later 30s. I'm probably never going to get married. But you know what? It's all okay. I'm probably not going to have kids. It's all okay. I've made my decisions. I have to live by it. Yeah. And, you know, at 38, I met a man that I did marry. Mm-hmm. So at that time, we dated, we got married. I was 39. And prior to getting married, we had a conversation around family, you know, having children. And he being, you know, in his mid to late 30s himself, was of the mindset that he wasn't going to have children himself. So we just thought, you know, that part of our lives is over. Mm-hmm. So we weren't bothered about it. It'd be okay. It would just be the two of us. Yay. And we got married.
Travel around the world, just the two of you.
Yeah, you know, we'll have a good life, you know. Yeah. Not actually realizing or understanding what that truly meant. We didn't. We just thought, you know, it was quite an easy, blasé conversation. That's it. Done. Sorted. Let's move on. So we got married. I was 39. At 40, because I had a lovely first year of marriage, I actually remember thinking that actually I didn't want to go through menopause and not have tried.
Okay.
So I approached my husband with this conversation about, you know, I really wanted to try, which did surprise him. I mean, essentially, I changed the rules. Mm-hmm. I just switched up on him, you know, which he thought, this is a bit strange, but okay. I think the promise of sex helped to sway him. You know, we'll have sex a lot. Okay. He was convinced. He was sold. So we embarked on 3 years of trying to conceive. And I kind of, in a way, was quite practical about it in terms of, well, I'm 40, the odds are against me, it might not happen anyway, but let's see what happens. If it's meant to be, it will happen, you know. Again, we were very blasé about it. And given that I had been pregnant before and was never in a relationship, so we're talking about, you know, one time, one encounter, and it getting pregnant, I did not expect this journey, this part of my journey, to be so hard. I really, truly believed that it would have been very easy. We would have had sex and I'd been pregnant within a few months. And a few months turned into a year. A year turned into 2 years. And it was like, what is going on here? Because this now made no sense. Mm-hmm. Because it should have worked. And also, no one tells you that there isn't a possibility that it won't work. Mm. You know, everyone has a story of how it's going to work. Even though, until you are in this place of trying and it not happening, you don't hear those stories either. Because I suppose we don't need to, because no one needs to give you those miracle baby stories. Mm-hmm. So I remember getting very anxious about it, and I kept questioning, and it turned really difficult. Our relationship turned really difficult because my husband felt like I was treating him for a piece of meat, and essentially I just wanted him for his sperm. Okay. You know, there was no romance. It all went. There was, you know, forget, why are you kissing me? Let's get on with it. You know, come on.
You're wasting time. Listen, you're wasting time with foreplay.
Exactly. We're on a time clock here. Come on now. You know, can you remember when you first get with someone, you got the music, Barry White's playing.
You've got the lingerie and exactly. The rose petals and something nice to drink and everything. Yeah, now it's the headscarf.
Listen, it don't matter how we look. Turn the lights off. We won't see each other anyway. Get on with it. So it became very, very robotic. I mean, I at the time I didn't see this, but when I processed at the end of that part of my journey, mm-hmm. I realized how hard it would have been for him. It was hard for both of us. And also it's lonely and isolating because how many people tell everyone else that they're trying for a baby?
Yeah.
You know, very few. So you're embarking on this journey on your own. Because mm-hmm. part of it is you don't want people to keep asking you every minute, are you pregnant yet?
And you know what? As funny you should say that, though, Yvonne, because I was just speaking to someone and I was letting them know of my experience. It would have been within, I think it would have been within the first year of getting married. We got married the October and moved to the US the March. And within, so, and then within the, that year of moving to the US, still within the first year of our marriage, I remember I would be calling a family member and his wife would always answer the phone. And she would always say, "Are you pregnant yet, Al? Are you pregnant yet?" Every time. "Are you pregnant yet? Are you pregnant yet?" And I remember that, and this was at the, this was before I knew anything medically and physically was wrong. Because, like I said, we hadn't been married that long. So we weren't like trying, like, "Oh my God, it hasn't happened yet." And, but there was something within me that, because very similar to yourself, I got married at 40. So I knew, just like, listen, my biological clock was saying,
"You gotta get on with it."
Seriously, my biological clock was like, "Hello, you see the time, you see the time, you see what's going on here." So, but her doing that, and bearing in mind by now, she's already a mother of four and a grandmother. And I've just, and I remember, I remember saying to her, "Okay, can I speak to your husband, please?" Because I'm related to her husband. And I said, "Tell your wife, I said, do not ask me that question again." And he's like, what, you know, she's only, and I said, tell your wife, I said, do not ask me that question again. And he obviously must have relayed the message, because whenever I called after that, she didn't ask me the question. But it was just like, hold on a second. We're still within our first year of marriage. I don't need every time I call on the phone to you, "Are you pregnant yet? Are you pregnant yet? Are you pregnant yet?" Fast forward a couple of years, get to find out there's actually a medical issue and you know, things, you know, deeper than that. So I hear what you're saying when people are constantly on you and
at
you. And I would hear comments such as, "What are you waiting for? You're getting older. Your eggs are going to
die."
And, you know, I just want to say to people, let me explain something to you. Stay out of my uterus. Stay away from my eggs. They're none of your business. Thank you, though. Thank you.
There's such an insensitivity around it, you know. There's no one even knows if you want to have children anyway, because that's another thing. People don't tell you about to make a choice.
That's not the question I was ever asked. Do you want to? Are you pregnant?
There's this construct that we're all supposed to live by, so therefore, you know, I call it the scripts. You do this, and the next, you know, then you get married, then you have kids. And there's no option for anything else. And, you know, and we see that with how women grieve the loss of motherhood. And, you know, I remember having people put babies in my lap and go, "Oh, you need the practice." Like, oh, and I was really at the height of my grief when this was happening. You know, people did not know. And then when I told people, I think I got a bit insulted and upset when I did start to tell people, when I came out of, when I got to a place where I could tell people what I'd been going through. And that's only because at this point I was in Gateway Women, I was doing the Plan B mentorship program, so I was working through my grief. And that's a term I tend not to use anymore, but I was working through it. And so I was in a place where I was felt stronger to be able to say, "This is what's been happening." And then people will say to me, "Oh, I didn't think you'd want children." So they assumed. And I was like, "What?" And it almost, the part of it was because of my age. So at this time I would have been 44 at 43, I got the diagnosis. And then, and that was in October. In December, I did my first workshop with Gateway Women, and then in February 2015 I started their Plan B mentorship program. So somewhere along in 2015 I was starting to be more open. And so I would have been, as I said, 44, and people, I think people were doing this because of your age, we didn't think you'd want to have children. And I realized people weren't asking me if I'm pregnant yet, because A, they were assuming I didn't want to, or they assumed I was just too old and it wasn't happening,
and that was it.
And I was like, I'm really insulted by that. I was, that hurt, it hurt to kind of realised that as well.
So the thing is, there's no middle ground between either of them for anybody actually taking that step and asking you, oh, so do you want children? How comes it hasn't happened for you yet? Nobody's asking the right questions. It really is. If you think about it, even though they're asking, are you pregnant yet? That's still an assumption, because you've got some women that are not trying and they're not pregnant and they don't want to have. And then you have those women that are trying that do want to have. So even that question is just people just making assumptions. Nobody's asking. It's a bit like, what's that movie with Will Smith? iRobot, you're asking the wrong question.
Oh, yes.
Nobody's asking the right question.
Yeah.
The questions that they are asking are based on presumptions.
Yes. Yeah. It is. And I think it feeds back into these matriarchal, you know, constructs that we're living in. So we are in this society that says we have to be married as women and we have to have children. And we have to have everything alert.
And the thing is, that's not everybody's destiny, though, is it?
Exactly. I think, you know, for me, so I kind of don't like the term that's not everyone's destiny, although I understand why what you mean by it. But I'm saying that from the point of view, is one of my triggers in my grief, one of the things I found really hard during my grief when I was really grieving was, or I should say deeply grieving, because I am still in grief. We never get over this. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a lot of women asking me when it will end. It doesn't end.
It never does.
Easier to manage, mm-hmm. you know, because that's all it's about. It's about how we manage it and how we put in the tools and the coping mechanisms in place so that we can manage it differently. Mm-hmm. But one of the things for me about the destiny part of it is that women used to say to me, and I only ever got this from black women, was, or maybe it's not God's will for you, or God knows what he's doing, or God's no mess. So under that, I suppose, an umbrella of destiny, that's the words I hear in terms of, it, you know, it wasn't God's plan for your life. When actually, for me, God's plan for my life was to be healthy and happy and live it how I want to live it.
Yeah, and fulfilled.
If his fundamental plan is, you know, you can make the choices that you want to make in life, then whatever I do, I'm living that. I think the whole thing around it is, we're not engaging in constructive, healthy conversations that actually allow people to make choices, that tell people they have choices, and actually however they choose to live their life is fine. It is, you know?
Yeah, no, because in saying that, when I say, and part of when I say it's not everybody's destiny, because I'm looking at it from the thing of, you could want something as much as you want something, but if it's not for you or the right thing for you, because you've got many women that don't want to have children.
Yeah.
And so not having children is their destiny because they don't want it.
Yeah.
And then you've got some women that do want, but because of like in our cases, because when you were actively trying, medically you couldn't. And in my case, from what I've been told, medically I never would have been able to. So I know that that's something that I have to look at and think, okay, biologically, having a child, unless by some miracle, that's not.
See, this is the other difficulty around it all, because I've met, you know, I working with Gateway Women now, I've become a trained facilitator to run or to facilitate the Gateway Women Reignite Weekend Workshops. And I've had so many conversations, I've heard so many stories, and I really, I'm not, even on my own journey, people ask us about, you know, why don't we have children? And there's never an element, because there's a lot of judgment around that question as well. And there's never an element of, there was a reason why it didn't happen in terms of, or a medical reason why it didn't happen. It's always comes down to, we're selfish, we're career women,
label.
And it's always a negative label. And this is another thing that women who are grieving are struggling with, because mm-hmm. there are so many stories around recurrent miscarriages, cancer, hysterectomies, early menopause. You know, I more recently found out I had adenomyosis, which would have affected my ability to conceive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Gabrielle Union has talked about her journey mm-hmm. and with adenomyosis as well. So there are so many reasons that can work against us when we want to get pregnant.
Absolutely.
That people are not even kind of considering that. There are other possibilities other than, oh, you're just being this
that
selfish
goes
person.
Back to the questions that people ask yes. are based on assumptions, because I was having a conversation with a man about this, because his wife hasn't been able to get pregnant. And in his culture, he's African. So in his culture, women are automatically labeled witches.
Yes.
Or
yes.
they're mean. And I was looking at it and I thought, that's interesting, because in that culture, the woman is mean, the woman is a witch, the woman is all these negative things. Mm. And then in Western society, Western culture, it's because she's selfish. It's because she's career driven. It's because supposing this woman that you perceive as being mean has become that way because she's had a desire that has not been fulfilled because she cannot. So therefore, she became bitter, and it was because it was internalized.
Yeah.
Just supposing that woman that is career-driven woman became that way again because she was not able to have a child. So what she did, she threw herself into her career. Both of those are ways of masking.
Yes.
The pain. And I'm not saying either one of those are fully healthy, but people do at times.
But it happens.
Sometimes people have to do what gets you from Monday to Tuesday to Wednesday to Thursday. Sometimes if that's all you can focus on to get through each day, I would recommend people get the healing and the counseling that they need. But sometimes before you can get to that, you have to just put in a mechanism to get through each day. And don't get me wrong, there are those women that are bitter and mean, not because they can't have children, just because they're just bitter and mean. There are those, let's not get it twisted here. There are those women. And there are those career-driven women that are that way, because not because of any other reason other than their career is their life. They do not want to have children, and that's it. So you do have those.
But here's the thing.
The assumption is everybody falls under that umbrella without everybody asking the question. The question's based on presumption.
Yeah, and the problem with all of this is that the women, you know, it's almost like us as childless women, women without children, who are all childless, not by choice, are labelled in that way, which is seen as very negative.
Mm-hmm.
But there are mothers who are doing the same thing. Come on, you know, there are mothers who are selfish. There are mothers who are career different. You know, it's how this language is used to keep us in our place or put us down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is something, again, through the Reignite workshops, this is something we really explore and we talk about because there's such a silence and reductiveness around this terminology that it stops women from getting the healing. I mean, we feel the shame anyway. You know, I know when I processed what was going on with my grief, because I didn't understand it as grief in the first place. So that's another thing people don't allow us to do is grieve.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we haven't lost anything in their minds.
Mm.
But we have. We've lost a dream. We've lost a hope.
Exactly.
We've lost.
And in some women's cases, like in my own, I've had 3 miscarriages.
Yeah.
So what I'm not supposed to grieve that.
Yeah, it's you know, we don't as a our culture doesn't deal with grief in a very healthy way, because unless if your husband died, if your child died, people would be like, yeah, you should be grieving. If you weren't crying about it, people would be cussing us, you know, we'd be cussed. Why aren't you?
But even with that, come a certain point, it's like,
of course, there's a time frame, there's a limit.
Yeah,
there is a time limit on it. And I think that's the whole thing with the grief model, is that people think it's this linear process. So you go from the start to the end and then you're done, which is not true.
It's
not true, exactly. And it's always what people say it should be as well.
Mm.
So again, you're not allowed to do it how you want to do it. But within the whole, you know, this whole reductive language that has been, and labels that have been put on us, we then become silenced. And we're already silenced. I mean, A, we feel ashamed that we couldn't conceive. I certainly, one of the things that really hit me with my grief was the shame. It was crazy. I just felt shamed of the fact that I had terminations. So it had to be my fault.
Right.
I was the reason why I couldn't get pregnant because of these stupid things I had done in my past. This was the language I was using. I certainly don't use that now.
Good.
Because we need to change that. And that's the whole beauty of having a space where you can do that. But in the absence of it, we are stuck in no one allowing us to be grieving, everyone questioning why we'd be sad, especially because we can do something about it. And I'm using inverted, you know, quotation marks here because, you know, because of all the miracle baby stories, no one realizes why they're miracle baby stories. But for every miracle baby story, there's probably 3-4 where it didn't work. And I've heard them all. Goodness. But, you know, because you can just have IVF, because you can just turn up, because you can just go and get your antibodies tested and they can give you a cure and give you this pill and da-da-da-da-da. People don't understand. People don't allow, accept that there will be women without children because you couldn't really have wanted it enough if you didn't go to the nth degree to get it.
And it's so funny.
Even within that part of the journey, we don't have a choice. We still don't have
a choice. Because you still have to do what they say. Because I remember a couple of things happened to me, really. It's that after the difficulties and everything, it was just like, so why don't you just adopt then? So I just thought, I tell you what, I'll just go and pop down. The next time I go to the mall, I'm just going to go into one of the shops then, just pick up a baby, shall I? Because it's that easy. I'm just going to just go pick one up.
Because, and there's so many women I've met that have been rejected as adoptive parents.
You see, there's that. And to be honest with you, if we really stop and think about it, you can be rejected in the adoption process. Does anybody actually ever stop to think just what that, so your body can't do what you feel by naturally it's supposed to be able to do, so you can't do that, you can't get pregnant, now you've been rejected from this.
Exactly.
Does people understand how emotionally, mentally, psychologically,
and
everything
with IVF, I mean, people think these are all simple things, just go and do it. As I said, I've met so many women that as either on their own or as a couple, and we're talking about married couples as well as, you know, cohabiting, were rejected from the adoption process.
Wow.
And for various reasons. And, you know, even with, again, IVF, people think just have IVF because you can do it.
Because and, it's cheap, right? You can just go and get it. It's cheap. Because, like,
we're talking
like
about, you're popping a pain. I know. And we are talking about, what, 4 to 8 grand per cycle? And it depends where you go, because you can pay up to 20
grand. Oh, sorry, did you say 4 to 8 grand as in 4 to 8,000 pounds?
£1,000, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And it can go up to £20,000, because it depends where you go and if, you know, on the clinic. So it does vary. And also, we're talking about a procedure, a process, that does crazy things to your body because all the hormones you put in. So you're having to hyperstimulate the eggs, and I'm sure I've got that term wrong, but and people will understand what I mean by that. And also, there's a 75% failure rate.
Hold on, sorry, 75%.
Wow. So, you know, that's why these are miracle baby stories.
Wow.
You know, I think people, and I'm not going to knock anyone, exactly. People have got to do what they feel best for them. I wouldn't knock anyone for doing, for whatever route they take. But the point is allow people to make the choices that they need to make that best serves them.
Yeah, without the added pressure.
Exactly. And I know for myself, because I've had the question a lot about did you not consider IVF? Did you not want to adopt? And that felt it was horrible to actually be in those spaces because I felt I had to justify it.
Mm.
And therefore in that justification, it was, I felt I was being judged for not wanting it enough. I didn't, and I actually questioned even myself. I was questioning myself. Did I really want to be a mum? Because I didn't go down these routes.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the things I realized was that, again, through my grief work, was that because I questioned, why did I want to be a mum? So many questions came up. Why did I do this? Why did I make this choice? And I realized that I needed to grieve before I could make any other choices.
Mm-hmm.
And to going through that process then allowed me to be in a place where I felt that I didn't want to do anything else because that was healthy. That was the best thing for me. And also my marriage was falling apart. Wow. So to then be going, oh yeah, let me try IVF with this fragile marriage, or let me, I couldn't, you know, it just, that's such an emotional journey in itself. And I've watched women go through it. I've known of women, I've heard their stories. I've known of close friends go through it. It's hard.
And it is hard. Do you think your marriage would have survived that pressure?
I don't. I think it would have been trying to put a plaster over this very massive gaping hole. And it probably would have, I would probably would have had to stretch the plaster to just touch the ends of each gap. But it wouldn't have, no, I couldn't do it. I was emotionally low. I was coming through this grief. Then I was grieving the breakdown of my marriage. You know, it was hard. It was really hard. And I just couldn't, and also I could, you know, think about this adoptive child coming into this home where we're not even stable. You know, you can't do that. I'm sure people would have seen through it. I don't know. I really don't know. But for me, it just wasn't a possibility. I had a lot to work out, and I had a lot to heal from. And so the option of doing that wasn't there. So, and then also I'm talking now, I would have been 45, 46, 47. So, you know, then I was of an age where I was starting to like who I was, and I was starting to get my mojo back. As you know, again, the silence keeps us in this place of brokenness. And, you know, I see this outside of childless journey. I see this in so many people where they're like, well, I'm not broken, I'm fine, I'm okay. And they've come out of really difficult situations. You know, you cannot be in any situation, any relationship. You can't leave it and leave it whole because you've left a piece of you there.
Yeah.
And I think we're so fragmented from all the experience, with whatever experience we go through. And also our past comes back up. So if we actually haven't dealt with past and healed and learnt from it, we carry that on.
Absolutely.
We cannot do anything other than carry it on. And we're doing it so unconsciously because we're not aware. Mm-hmm. And again, go back to the language, go back to our teachers. We're not taught about this. So therefore we don't do anything about it because we don't know we have to or need to. But you know, I think all that stuff, I think there's a moment in life, and for me it was realizing I wouldn't be a mum, and I've seen it with a lot of other women too in terms of the childless journey, is there's that moment is the trigger. It's almost like you implode.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that stuff, all sorts of stuff come into this grief, and you need to start unpacking it because it's heavy. That grief around, you know, I see these women, they're heavy, they're sad, they're broken because they really wanted to be a mum and it's not going to happen.
And I'm sure in some cases as well that their marriages may not have survived pressure. You've got these women, like you said, they're heavy carrying, or not heavy as in weight heavy, but they're just, like, psychologically,
the emotional journey,
they're weighed down emotionally, mentally, and then of the grief that they're going through, not being able to have had a child, and then in some cases their marriages didn't survive.
Yeah, there's all sorts. So and that's another
too much.
that's another sad part of it, because I remember at some point earlier on in my journey, my grief journey, I was somebody said to me, oh, but it's really great you and your husband are doing it together, and we weren't. That was part of my sadness.
You know what? That's exactly what I wanted to ask you, because I wanted to ask you, you're in this journey that you were going through because you having adenomyosis, you realize that, hold on, so it's me that can't get pregnant, not him. And I know you can't speak to his emotions, his feelings, and his journey on it, but if you can, where was he in this? What was, what, you know, how was, if, did he share with you how he was feeling? What was happening for him?
No. At the beginning, I shut down. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a lot of resentment towards him. I literally did shut down. He felt it.
Okay.
And he did at that time think I was, she's going to leave me. What's going on? Mm-hmm. And but I was really struggling with understanding what I was going through. I couldn't articulate these words that I didn't understand. All I knew is I was just sad all the time, and I wanted to cry all the time. And if somebody told me they were pregnant, I'd go off and cry. If I was on a train and saw young families, I'd want to get off and cry. It was crazy. It was horrible. It was crazy. And so, yeah, I didn't understand what this meant. I didn't understand what it meant for me or for us. And so I couldn't talk about it. I didn't have the words. So because I found Gateway Women, and then I was on the program and around other women who got it. Mm-hmm. And it's that get it in terms of you can say this is how I feel and it's normalized and you don't have to explain, because everyone 100% gets what you're feeling, what you're going through. Mm-hmm. And also it's all allowed, because outside of that space people want to fix us, hence the whole why don't you just do this and why don't you just do that. So therefore you can't then fully talk about your experience, and you feel ashamed for thinking some of the things we're thinking. So therefore that's another difficulty. So then now I've tried to talk to you about it, and you shut me down with your fixing. Mm-hmm. Therefore I'm not going to try anymore, and I feel so guilty and I feel ashamed, la 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 la. And you get, well, you shouldn't feel like that, you've got a good job, what's going on? So you know, again, we're silenced. So being in that forum, being in that space where I had these women that understood and got it and allowed me to grieve, meant that I didn't need to go and talk to my husband. So therefore I stopped talking to him. And it, again, that was part of the rift in terms of what we experienced at that time. So for me, again, feeling the resentment, part of it was because I didn't see him grieving. I didn't see any sign of he wanted this as much as I did, that he was sad about it. So I just really hated on him. One thing I did learn was that, and I remember Jodie Day telling me this, was that she had found, because she had counseled couples through this situation, she had found that what tends to happen is the man remains strong while the woman's grieving.
Right.
When she's in a way finished, and I'm using air quotation marks here, when she's finished grieving or come to a place where she feels stronger, then it's almost like he has now permission to grieve, because he feels like he's holding her and holding the relationship together. And essentially that's kind of what I saw, as much as my husband didn't kind of confess all these emotions about it, I started at some point to see signs. He started to say little things, like, for example, he was watching a show and seeing a dad teaching his kid to ride a bike, and he went, I realized I'd never have that moment. And that's when I started to realize and
appreciate his pain.
Because
you see that, and I think what a lot of us as women need to realize is just because he doesn't say anything doesn't mean he's not feeling anything.
Yeah. I think this is where I wished we could have communicated better. Mm-hmm. And I want to be clear, you know, I'm saying this, not every marriage breaks up. I've had so many people say to me, is it because of the child thing that you broke up? And I'm like, no, married couples break up, you know, and there are, I know, childless. Yeah. You know, and I know couples who've gone through this and became strong and remain strong. Mm-hmm. It comes down to how your relationship started in the first place and what your foundations were. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot of things I realize, and I'm not sitting here wanting to put my husband down in any way. Mm-hmm. Because my marriage, I ended, you know, it did end, but I also left it with love from the, mm-hmm. because I had processed as well, but I left it. I was able, mm-hmm. I was in therapy to help me work through the grief of losing my marriage. So I was able to let it go with love and wish him all the best, because mm-hmm. I wouldn't want anything less. We had some great times. He's like, you know, we really had some great times. There was a reason why I married him, yeah, and I certainly didn't want to leave it with hate, because mm-hmm. that wasn't going to be healthy for me. Mm-hmm. So I was fortunate that I had someone around me saying, maybe this is time to go in therapy, which I did. Again, somebody saw something in me and said, mm-hmm. Yvonne, go and get help. And I listened, and I'm so glad I did, because it really helped me to process. And all that, you know, the grief work I did with Gateway Women and Jodie Day, the grief work I did through my therapy sessions really helped me to open up, to be honest, to be vulnerable, to own my story, because in the absence of that, I would never have healed. I really had to own a lot of stuff in my story that I didn't want to look at. You know, that trunk, I threw it in the sea. It was wrapped up with weights and it was thrown in the sea, never to be seen again. But I had to go diving and pick it up.
Yeah.
And retrieve it, open it up and look inside. But I couldn't do the work I'm doing now in terms of the public speaking, supporting women who are grieving the loss of motherhood. I couldn't do all of that without having have done the work on myself.
On yourself first, of course. Yeah. Absolutely. Because you wouldn't be being authentic for those women anyway. Yeah. And it'd be a hypocritical double standard. You can't
this
be
is true.
People like go and go and do this, go and work on your stuff. This is what you need to do. And yes. then you go home and you're a basket case and you're a mess.
Yes.
Because you haven't yeah. done what you
Sometimes
need.
Sometimes I still do. Am, but you know, I don't sit there for a long time. No, but this is life.
I don't think, but it's like you were saying earlier, and it's one of those things when I think a lot of people don't realize or appreciate this. It's not something, and I use the air quotes, it's not something you can ever get over.
Yes.
Because you're not, it's not like you can That's have it. This desire and this longing to be a mother and have a baby. And then all of a sudden, okay, I've grieved, I'm fine, I don't want it now. Yeah. You know, it's not a piece of
it's
food.
You can, no.
It's like prime example, right? Now, I don't really eat much in the way of sweets. But get me like barbecue Pringles and potato chips and that, then, oh, Lord. I know, don't judge me, people. But I remember I really fancied a piece of chocolate. And I like Kit Kat and Twix. So, and I remember I went and I bought, and I'm like, I really want some chocolate, really want some chocolate. And I bought, by the time I was in the supermarket, I didn't really have the desire anymore. But because earlier on I had said I wanted it, I bought this Kit Kat. Went back to work and I put it in my desk drawer. The next time I'm like, oh, you know something? I really fancy a piece of chocolate. Do you know by the time I pulled that Kit Kat out, it was past its best by date?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that I use that is like people think that's what the emotion is like. Mm. I had the desire and then it passed and now I'm all right. And it's, you know, it's not like that Kit Kat where I really, really, really wanted it.
Yeah.
And by the time I got it, I'm like, yeah. And then the desire had passed. I could just put it down and shove it.
Yeah.
It's not like
this
that.
This is true. No, this is true. There's times I can still, I mean, I still struggle with pregnancies and newborns. That is my real trigger.
Yeah, I've never touched a pregnant belly. I'm not there.
Like, no, I would have. There was a time when I would have been all up in there, but no, I won't. I can't hold a newborn. I still will cry. And the thought of it, because there's this whole thing around. I remember it might have been a couple of years ago now, but my dad, who has grandchildren, was talking about his granddaughter reminiscing, so it would be my niece who's reminiscing on this silly story, but the look in his face when he was telling mm-hmm. it, you know, the joy, of his remembrance, I just burst out crying. I mean, it did shock my dad because he was like, what the hell? I'm just telling you a funny story and what's going on?
A black man seeing his child, grown adult child crying. It's like, huh?
And well, that's another thing. That's a whole other thing. But, you know, it was that realization that he will never have these stories of my children. And I was even writing a blog recently and talking about carnival and the memories of me and my dad and how what he used to get us to do. And I was like, you know, I'm never going to have these stories of my children. My children are never going to have these memories of me. And I was crying because it is that, you know, we had a hope. Yeah. And although hope keeps you in denial, because it does, we had a hope. But what we need to be able to do is move from hope to this place of acceptance. Mm-hmm. And not just from other people, because other people need to accept it too, mm-hmm. for sure. But we need to move into it in a place of acceptance for ourselves, mm-hmm. so that we can get which is part of our healing, and we can find our joy again, because we, oh my God, have lost joy. We have lost this zest for life. What is the point of going on anymore? And so we do, you know, we need it. We need it. And I have found that, particularly as a black woman, that because I'm out there speaking about it, because I'm visible and being very vulnerable with it, it's giving other women, black women, Asian women, permission to talk too. Now, not everyone's going to do what I'm doing. I know that. But even just to be able to say to a friend, to a family member, I'm struggling here. I couldn't have children, or, you know, whatever their version of the story they want to tell. Mm-hmm. But even to own it, mm-hmm. that's huge. It is huge. I've come across so many black women that have contacted me and said thank you. And also, because culturally, we don't talk.
Exactly. You
know, don't talk about problems outside of the home.
And that's just it. And sometimes, forget about outside the home. We don't talk inside the home culturally.
This is true.
If you're not talking inside the home, how in the world are you going to speak once you get inside?
And this stuff is huge. So again, if we're not talking about the small stuff, we're not going to talk about the big stuff, for sure. We need to feel safe to do it. And again, black people don't want to talk to white people about stuff. You know,
And let me just put a disclaimer here. Not because we're prejudiced or anything like that.
Yeah.
But it's a thing where I remember I was working, there was somewhere I was working, and a woman asked me a question which would have made me have to explain, give the answer and then have to explain to her the cultural aspect of it. And the way she responded was, my goodness, how bizarre. And I wanted to say to her, oh, I don't think my culture is bizarre, but thank you though. You know, and because sometimes if you're speaking to another black person, if I'm speaking to somebody whose family's from Jamaica, there are some things I don't have to try to explain. Yeah. And then there's some, and in explaining it, I won't feel judged by those things that you're thinking that my culture's weird, my culture's strange. And I think for some parts of it, so just so people don't think that black women don't want to speak to white women because we're prejudiced, that is not it. It literally is because it's an affinity. You want to speak to somebody that you have an affinity with, that looks like me, that sounds like me, that may have had some of the same experiences as me, in the sense of, I could talk about something that we ate and was like, well, we were all eating oxtail rice and peas. I don't want to have to then...
You don't have to explain.
Yeah, I don't have to explain it, because then we probably move off topic and start talking about how our mothers cooked oxtail, for goodness sake, and exchange recipes. So it's having that affinity and that cultural understanding, because, and like I was saying to you, in African culture, the woman's considered a witch, considered mean and all the rest of it. So speaking to another African lady that would explain that without clutching her pulse, thinking, oh my God, that's the worst thing I've ever heard. Witch?
That's right,
And that's a lot of what it is, that cultural aspect.
There's an understanding that we are looking for. As black women, when we're talking about our stuff, and mm-hmm. that's, you know, exactly what you've described. And here's another thing, we're stereotyped so much. There's so many unconscious stuff going on, mm-hmm. you know, so there is a trust element to this as well. Mm-hmm. And when we're being stereotyped, you know, angry black woman comes to mind because that's one I tend to experience a lot.
Yeah.
But angry black woman is one, you know, when we're being stereotyped to such a rate, and why do we want to be so vulnerable in that space?
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. You know, if I think about my childhood and things that I heard growing up, mm-hmm. you know, even, you know, how much we're dismissed.
Yeah, as
children in the school system, and then, you know, then as it goes on into the workplace, if we're experiencing that so much for everyday stuff, how are we then going to be so vulnerable when we really need help and understanding? We're not going to do it because we've lost the trust.
And there's a, you know, so Yvonne, did we lose it? Was it ever there?
I would say no. I would say it was never there.
No.
You're right. And, you know, it's something because I was asked the question. I remember Jodie Day, I think it was in 2018, approached me and said, Yvonne, why don't black women talk to me? Which I thought was crazy because I'm like, well, I'm talking to you. And I do, I talk to white people. Come on. This, you know, I think we're trying to show, we're trying to give an example, show what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of our culture and how we are in some respects existing
mm-hmm.
in certain spaces that we're in.
We're perceived in those spaces.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I remember reflecting back because I really, you know, Jodie and I have a very good relationship, and her asking me that question took me aback, and it really made me think about stuff. And then I had a conversation with my black friends, and I was like, oh my God. So when we started talking about our history, our past, our childhood,
mm-hmm.
it all started to come together and make sense in terms of what I was talking about, the yeah. lack of trust,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, we were always being put down. You know, I remember at school.
Absolutely.
Have you considered being a shopkeeper? You know, I wasn't good enough to do A-levels. You know, I was rejected to do A. I mean, I have a master's and a diploma in management, but I wasn't good enough to do A-levels.
But so we were good enough to win all their medals in sports, though.
But that's, and I was pushed to be into sports. I remember being pushed into sports at school. So when we're being stereotyped in such a way, we're learning not to trust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it keeps being reinforced. We probably already have those messages. We did have all those messages before. We could go right back to slavery and start to look at how these messages panned out. Because, you know, I remember a counselor friend of mine, we were talking about this, and when we kind of looked back at slavery and the fact that, okay, you know, what black person was being vulnerable and exposing themselves in terms of, you know, I'm hurting, I've got these needs or whatever to white people, because who was going to listen to them?
What do you mean who was going to listen? They didn't have the platform or the opportunity to even begin the conversation, much
there you go.
The audience.
The marriage, there you go. You know, we didn't have the space to talk about our problems. It was just get on with it because they didn't want to listen. When slavery ended, what support did we have to unpack this traumatic experience we lived? And, you know, Dr. Joy Geary, and I pronounce her surname wrong, who does studies on post-traumatic slave syndrome,
mm-hmm.
talks about this a lot. But, you know, we lived with the genetic memory of slavery. Mm-hmm. We have that genetic memory, we have that body memory. And if we've got it, white people have it too. Right. So if you see it playing out in things that are happening now in terms of how, again, the racial profiling, the how we're stereotyped, you know, they looked black, so they must have been guilty. Or sorry, not looked black, they are black, so they must be guilty. Absolutely. They have that kind of face. And, you know, I've experienced being kind of labelled as the angry black woman, and you must be wrong. You are wrong, or you've done it the wrong way, when I was the one actually that was being treated badly.
Yeah, of course, and having all of you to put all of these ideas forward for pieces of work, and next thing you know, they've hired a white guy to do all the ideas.
It's like,
hold on a second. Okay. So believe me.
So there's so many layers, around. So if we're facing this in our everyday life, women are not going to come, and men too. But why are these women who are going through this horrible grief? And we're literally propelled into it because it just, you know, you're trying, and then it's like it's not going to happen, and then I was propelled into that. But why they, you know, when they're in that situation, they're not going to readily go and just talk to anyone about it.
And then the other side of that is there's not that many black counselors for them to anyway. So you being there, in that space, in that room, is actually welcoming for more to start coming forward. Because to be honest, all you need to see is one face.
Which is true.
All you need to see is that one face, that one person that you feel that you have that affinity with.
Yeah.
For people to start coming, and then there will be more in that space.
Yeah.
And that is where you come in, Yvonne. Not to put all this pressure on you, not to speak. No pressure.
I remember at the start, I was like, I don't speak for all black people.
You see the thing, and that is the thing though, and I think that's a lot of what people need to realize, that you are Yvonne. You speak for Yvonne. You may be able to speak for those people you know, but you don't speak for all black women.
Absolutely.
Because to be honest, just like all white women are different, all black women are different.
Absolutely. And I know there'll be black people saying that's not my experience. Exactly. You know, I I'm just talking from my place of truth, my experience, and my experience in terms of what I do know now, or what I've come to realize now, has widened because of the stories I've heard. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the more we talk, the more we learn, the more we grow.
Exactly.
So, which has been such an enriching experience for me, and has been such an important part of my own healing. Because I think you can only get so far. And I think we know you can only get so far on your own. So the more people, the right people as well, are in our lives, the more we will, that it will expand our horizons. The more we will grow, the more we will heal.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, it's been, for me, it's been an amazing journey. And I still have anger. My anger probably isn't as evident as some other people's, but I still have anger. And when I looked, I mean, given that I do a lot of talking around the women of colors experience around fertility and infertility, I have learned again so much on that journey, which has in a way fueled more anger for the medical profession. Because when you look at the stats around black women in infertility, I'm like, well, how is it we're not getting the help we need? I mean,
those facts and figures, Yvonne.
So, and there's something I've talked about quite a lot and highlighted in a lot of my talks that I've done. So the Women's Health Magazine and Oprah Magazine surveyed more than 1,000 women in 2018 and reported that infertility affects at least 12% of all women up to the age of 44. Yet only 8% of black women between the ages of 25 and 44 seek medical help to get pregnant, compared to 15% of white women. Black women were more than twice as likely as white women to say they wouldn't feel comfortable talking about their fertility issues with anyone, friends, family, support room, with anyone, because they didn't see women who looked like them, and they felt they wouldn't be understood, which is exactly what we've been talking about. We've got the stereotype that black women don't have fertility issues, where fertility in black women is rarely discussed or acknowledged as a problem. We've got the breeding myths from slavery that perpetrate this, because black women are seen as not having problems with conceiving. We are taught that black women were hyperfertile or are naturally fertile. So the idea that we can't get pregnant is very foreign. So if society and the systems are generally systemically racist, so it is, you know, they're governed by white people. Look at the history here. They are predominantly governed by white people. the constructs are by white people. So if they're saying and seeing that we are hyperfertile, that why would then they start to think we have problems with fertility? I mean, I remember growing up here and we breed like rabbits.
Exactly.
So there's, there is this incorrect belief that we don't have problems.
Wow, that is so interesting. And it's so true, because black women labeled baby mamas, black men labeled baby daddies, and we've got all these children and everything running all over the place. So therefore, there is no space for us to say, well, actually, that's not my reality. Like that. Because like you said, it's very rarely discussed that people... and you could actually forgive the public for thinking that there's no problem or issue with fertility or infertility in the black community because of how rarely it is actually discussed.
So we go on. I mean, exactly that. And this is one thing I realised, again, from my own journey and then researching from that one question, why don't black women talk to me? Mm-hmm. I started to look deeper into this. And, you know, there are studies that show that black women suffer from fibroids 2 to 3 times more than white women. Black women tend to experience fibroids at a younger age and are more often severely than white women do. Mm-hmm. And again, we've got other things that affect our infertility or affect our fertility, such as endometriosis and adenomyosis, which we touched on before, mm-hmm. cervical mucosis problems, our age, recurrent pregnancy loss or miscarriages, unexplained infertility. These are at higher rates in black people. Mm. So, you know, if I'm sitting there thinking, I can read this and I see these stats, why am I going into my GP's office and them not knowing this?
And it's funny you should say that, because I exhausted almost every doctor in London, because I started taking birth control at the age of 18. The reason being, my monthly cycle, even though they were regular as clockwork, they were horrendous. I'm talking, I would be throwing up for the first couple of days. I was constantly anemic. The pain was, a doctor said it was like I was in labor every month. So at the age of 18, I decided, because before I was 18, the doctor said the only way to help is going to be birth control. And obviously my mom's like, oh no. So I didn't go on it. But you see, the minute I hit 18, I think I was 18 and one day, I was in that doctor's office like, give me that prescription.
I want it.
And so I was on that. But yet, it masked it, but it didn't fully help. And I went to doctor after doctor. I went to Harley Street. I don't even remember how I even paid for it. I ended up going to see a doctor on Harley Street. I went to Chelsea and Westminster, top gynecologists, private gynecologists all over the place. And all they were doing was they were scanning me and checking for fibroids. But because they didn't find fibroids, they were just like, oh, we don't know. And then it's not until I moved here to the US and a friend of mine who's originally from the UK, she said to me, Alison, demand a laparoscopy. Didn't know what that was. I looked it up. So I went to my gynecologist and I says, I would like a laparoscopy, please. And he's looking at me like, well, why do you want that? And I'm thinking, first and foremost, don't question me. Because, you know, here in the US, my insurance is paying for it. I'm paying for it. You're not going to be out of pocket. Don't question me. You see my medical history. And I said to him, because I'm tired of my monthly cycle constantly putting me in hospital. He did the laparoscopy and he says, you have adenomyosis, but you do have two options. I'm like, I have options. Great. He said, your options are either have a hysterectomy or learn to live with it. Those were my options. Those were my options. And like you said, I've never heard of adenomyosis. And look at, and like you were saying, with those statistics, with those facts and figures, the fact that I had to go and ask for that, the fact that I was constantly, both here in the US and in the UK, I was constantly going to the doctor. The amount of times I was taken to the emergency room, there was one time, and this is going to sound horrible and graphic, and my apologies, listeners, I remember I went to the bathroom in the hospital. By the time I came out, it looked like a scene from CSI. I was like, you know, it's one of those, I came out of there like, oh, I'm sorry for whoever's going to have to clean. I tried to clean it up.
Yeah.
It was literally like somebody being murdered and everywhere. And so they kept saying to me that I was having a miscarriage. I'm like, no, I'm not. They kept telling me, you have it. I'm like, my name's not Mary. I'm not doing anything to be pregnant at this point. No, I'm not having a miscarriage. So they did the pregnancy test, came back, says, oh, you're not pregnant. Surprise, surprise. I think I told you. And then they said that my monthly cycle was like I was in labor and having a miscarriage every 21 days. Mm-hmm. Because it was, but yet nobody thought to do any further investigation to see why this is even happening until I was in my 40s.
Yeah.
And I went to a doctor and I said, can I have a laparoscopy?
Yeah. It's, you know, you wouldn't be the first. I certainly had to push. I even had to push for fertility investigations, and I was 42, 43 at that time.
Mm.
You know, even then they were like, well, keep trying. I'm like, I'm of an age when actually they should have just been on that straight away, you know. And I had to lie. Well, I've been trying for years. And, you know, I had to lie just to get what I had the right to have in the first place. And similarly to you, I had really, really bad, really crappy periods. I mean, I got to this place where I couldn't function without painkillers, and I'd have to overdose just to have manageable pain.
Yeah, I was on codeine.
I was on codeine.
Codeidromol. I remember taking that and thinking, I can fully understand how people get hooked on prescription drugs because the way that made me feel was just like, oh, because that horrendous pain.
Yes.
And it got to the point where my body got used to the codeidromol.
Yeah, that's
the only
danger.
Thing that would help was morphine.
You were on some heavy stuff. Because I found, like, I mean, you know, this was years and years as well, and barely sleeping. So I'd have 3-4 nights that I would barely sleep because I'd be in pain.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, if I didn't overlap the medication, so, you know, take them every 4 hours. If I took them at 4 hours, I would start to feel pain. So therefore it's
2 hours.
Yeah. That I was doing the same because that's the only way I could keep the pain away
and function.
Without that I wouldn't be able to leave my house because I was in too much pain.
Absolutely.
And even then it would be touch and go. And then the flow was very heavy, so I was on tranexamic acid, which actually I remember somebody telling me, I remember a white lady telling me, you know, that was a lifesaver, her going on it, stopped her periods, she could function. I was like, what?
That in candy, you know, just pop in some.
Yeah, didn't stop mine at all. It just sometimes made it a bit more manageable, but I would still flood. I'd still leak. And then my periods in the last 2 years got very strange in terms of it would, you know, I would be on for 2 weeks sometimes, which was very odd for me. And then I would go down to light, so I'd be on a panty liner because I'm thinking it's a light day, and then I'd flood. So I'm not prepared. So it really changed. But, you know, again, I'd go to the GP, nothing would, they didn't even bat an eyelid at it. You know, just here's the tablets, here's the prescription.
Yeah. And you know,
I remember when I was,
before you've even sat down.
That's right. And I remember because I had fibroids. So I remember my when I was having the fertility investigations, because I'd known I'd had fibroids for years, and therefore it came up again with the fertility investigations, mm-hmm. to the point where they're like, oh, let's remove them because, you know, I'm trying to get pregnant and they can affect your chance of getting pregnant or conceiving. So then I had a procedure, then so while they were doing this investigation procedure, they were going to move the fibroids, but then turned around and said that because of the position they're in, they can't get them. Mm. But it shouldn't cause you any problems. Da, 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 da. Again, just bye, see you later. And they thought nothing of it. It wasn't until I got so anemic that a GP phoned me up and said, you know, your iron stores are, and my hemoglobin was low, my iron stores are really low. And at this point, and I had been like this for a good while anyway, mm-hmm. I'm like exhausted all the time. Didn't matter how much sleep I got, I'm exhausted. Then when mm-hmm. I'm on my period, I wouldn't sleep for like 2-3 nights because I'm waking up in pain, or I had to change, you know, I'd be up every 2-3 hours.
Yeah.
And then struggle to get back to sleep. So I was barely sleeping. So yeah, I was functioning. So I was barely functioning, you know, walking up a hill, I'd be out of breath.
Like,
and I'm fit. I exercise, yes. You know, and
needed 2 blood transfusions.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I got to this place where I started to have iron infusions mm-hmm. because that was my iron was so low. And then, so then I got in front of another consultant. So my GP's like, I want to investigate it. So I ended up in front of a consultant who then said, you know, fibroids can be misdiagnosed. So she wanted to do an MRI. Mm-hmm. So she did the MRI and found out I had fibroids and adenomyosis. Mm. And that kind of re-triggered some grief when I found out that could have affected my chances of conceiving. Mm. Mm. So it was really hard to go through that. But then, you know, as I said, I have my anger towards the medical profession because no one is looking at me as a black woman saying, ha, hang on, there's some stats that work against you. So we need to have more urgency. We need to, exactly.
To be honest, Yvonne, even without the stats, though, come on, let's think about
it. I know.
Even without the stats, let's use the medical term, the fact that you keep presenting over and over again with this thing, the fact that, like yourself, it was one of those things where I remember, like I said, when I was in the hospital and they thought I was having a miscarriage because my flow was that heavy, and I'm telling them no. And they says, oh my gosh, this is flooding. I'm like, well, the fact that that's what you see this, the fact that you realize that you were giving me morphine, and the morphine wasn't even lasting more than 20 minutes before I was in pain again. And that's when they said to me, it's literally like it's the equivalent of like I'm in labor every month, like how severe the pain is. And the flow is the equivalent of me actually miscarrying. That's how heavy it was. And I've been on iron treatment since the age of 16, if not earlier. But the fact that, like yourself, having these iron infusions, having blood transfusions, because my blood count was so low, a nurse said she doesn't know how I walked into the hospital.
Yeah.
She says I'm supposed to be going into organ failure and be in a coma. And the fact that all of that, so forget statistics.
Yeah.
My medical history was not saying,
Well, you see, this is the difficulty in terms of this systemic racism that we see in these systems, because that alone is going to stop us from getting the help we need.
Mm.
You know, the stats just show what we already know.
Yeah.
Really. You know, because it's, they you know, I remember when because again, you know, having the adenomyosis, I was, just because of fibroids, I was told my only cure was a hysterectomy, and I went crazy over that one. Yeah, it was a male consultant who had told me this. So again, you're kind of thinking, you're a woman, you've got fibroids, let's get rid of your womb. And I really resisted that.
Mm.
And I remember, so then when I did have the adenomyosis diagnosis, again, I was told the only cure was a hysterectomy, which I did find out was true in terms of medicine research. I realized, okay, this is a fact.
Mm-hmm.
But one consultant wanted to try other things. She wanted to try a marina coil. So I went to another consultant because I just wanted to get a second opinion. And so I'm in front of a white male consultant. The female consultant was an Asian lady. So I think that's what helped in terms of how she looked at it differently.
Mm-hmm.
This white male consultant just looked at my notes and he went, your womb is too diseased. There's nothing we can do.
Oh.
And I lost count. I remember I did a talk recently for Endometriosis UK. And I remember saying during that talk, I lost count of how many times that man said I had a diseased womb.
Wow.
It was horrible. I mean, I think that's all I remember hearing, to be honest. Mm. I couldn't tell you anything else other than the fact that I have a diseased womb. And to hear that, oh my God, I have no words to describe how crap I felt, actually. It just added to my grief. I'm like, and at this point, because this is another thing, you know, we're going to go through as women who couldn't have children for whatever reason, was that we're going to have this very disenfranchised, fragmented, disjointed, I could use a whole heap of different words here, relationship with our wombs.
Yeah.
You know, because our wombs didn't do what it should have done. Our bodies didn't do, you know, even in our bodies itself, it didn't do what it should have done as a woman. Mm. And I remember, because I was so glad I was in therapy, actually, because I had a lot to process. You know, again, now I'm childless. I'm dealing with the grief of, you know, not becoming a mum. Mm-hmm. And then my marriage is breaking up, so I'm dealing with the grief of that. And then I'm told, hey, you're gonna lose your womb. You know, I'm like, no, it's not gonna happen. I mean, I resisted it for like 3 years.
Likewise, I tried acupuncture.
I can't say I certainly didn't do loads of stuff, but I just thought it's not gonna happen. Yeah. And it was strange because I hated my womb, I was angry at my womb. But I didn't realize that until I processed, and my therapist really helped me work through it, to the point where I then wrote a letter to say goodbye to my womb. At this point, I suppose I was in this position where I realized I needed to do it. I needed to have the hysterectomy. And I have a good friend who said to me, Yvonne, don't look at it as losing your womb. Look at it as losing the pain and having a better quality of life, which helped me. And again, this is why we need to have the right people in our lives. We need to know that the people are there telling us this stuff because they care. Mm. And they want the best for us. I'm not talking about the people who are trying to fix us, because I know, and it, you know, I know families, friends don't want to see us be hurt.
Yeah.
But the fixing part of it doesn't help in terms of why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? Mm. For me, having someone just show me another way of looking at my situation so I could make peace with the decision that I needed to make was helpful.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't have done that on my own.
Yeah, I can appreciate that, because I think for me, it was all the iron infusions, the fact that I'd already had one blood transfusion and was told, I don't even know how you walked in here. You're supposed to be by rights, you're supposed to be unconscious in a coma, hooked up to four different machines, about to go into organ failure. And then 10 months later, in the hospital for another blood transfusion. That was the wake-up call for me, to be honest. Well, because for me, I looked at it as like, I'm literally dying to have
it. Yeah.
And then I was told that it would have been fatal for me.
Yeah.
So the pregnancies that I had, it would have been fatal for me to go through with that. If they didn't end in miscarriage, they would have been fatal for me anyway. Mm. I had to really look at that and say, like your friend said to you, you're going to have a better quality of life.
Yeah.
You can stop holding on to this thing that is literally killing you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, in the same vein, you know, us childless women don't want to hear, why don't you just try this? You know, we want it acknowledged and validated. You know, we want to hear things like, that must be really hard. You know, is there any support you can get?
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at, you know, how can you find a fulfilling life, you know, in all of this, because it must be really hard to go through this. You know, where can you find your joy? So in the same vein, you know, my friend told me that, I mean, I was having iron infusions every 3 months, purely because, and I was fortunate because I was under a consultant who knew me Mm-hmm. And know me for years and said, you know, get your referral to me and I'll look after you and manage, help to manage you. And every time he did a, you know, give me 2 infusions, 3 months later I'd have a blood test and my iron was exactly where it was before, which it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about my iron, I think it, at the worst was 8. The normal range starts at 14 to 200 something. I can't remember exactly, but you know, I was at 8. I think I was at 4 at one point. And I'll be having the infusion, I'll be back at 8. So that shouldn't happen.
Mm.
And he said, you're just bleeding it out, because I was, you know, every month, you know, I had 3 cycles by the time he'd done a blood test. So I just bled it all out again. So again, you know, the better quality of life,
it
just got me to sit down and think about it and really assess what would be best. Mm-hmm. For me to do, because it was about looking after myself as well, which is something I learned a lot through my grieving process in terms of self-care and putting things in place to really help manage my grief. So at that point then, you know, my therapist helped work through a lot of what I felt about the hysterectomy. Mm-hmm. And again, I said my relationship with my womb was very... not in a good place. So I wrote a letter to say goodbye to my womb, because I needed to tell her how I felt, because I was angry at her. I was really angry with her.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't allow me to experience the joy that I really wanted to experience with my husband.
Mm-hmm.
So once I said goodbye, I felt then I could take the next step and have my hysterectomy, which then happened May this year.
Okay.
But I was scared, I have to say.
Yes.
And, you know, I had processed a lot, and my fear was around, actually, as a black woman, being operated on. Because, again, stats, oh my goodness, don't look up stats before you have an operation. Don't do it. I mean, I kind of knew this before anyway, but, you know, black women in the UK are 5 times more likely to die from complications surrounding pregnancy and childbirth than white women. You know, there are women out there, Candice Braithwaite being a British author is one of them, that talks about how she feels a victim of racial bias around the time she gave birth to her daughter. Serena Williams has talked about the bias, the difference she has experienced as a black woman, you know. And I don't want to really talk about mothers, because of the fact, you know, I know it's a trigger for childless women. However, you know, I'm just using these as examples to show what's happening in the system. And, you know, the death rates are higher. You've got women that are, there's something around pain. We don't, you know, again, if you go back to slavery time, there was experiments done on enslaved women, and operations were done without anesthesia because it was believed we didn't feel pain.
We didn't feel pain, that's right.
Yeah. So there's this thing around, you know, how we are not looked after in the same way as white women. So I remember, because I had my operation during COVID, and therefore could only be dropped off at the hospital, had to go in on my own. And it felt like this long walk down this lonely corridor. It was so surreal. Got in there. I mean, the nurses and everything, they're all friendly. But I remember sitting there minutes, you know, waiting to go down for my surgery. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to die because I'm a black woman. That's all I kept thinking. I'm going to die because I'm black. Because I know there's such a disparity in how black people are treated in the NHS, let alone in other places, you know. But there's such a disparity. And I just really felt that I wasn't going to be cared for, looked after, that something was going to happen and I wouldn't survive. It was crazy.
Thankfully, you've come through the surgery and all is well.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
I know. I think I was grateful that an Asian woman, an Asian gazelle was operating on me, because kind of felt like she'll look after me.
So Yvonne, tell me. So now that you've gone through all of that and you brought us right up to May of this year, what's next for you?
Yay. What's next? Well, I still facilitate the Reignite Weekend Workshops, which has gone online now. So it's been a new learning for me to be trained and run them online. I am still on my healing journey, so I'm participating, hopefully, if the numbers are there, participating in a retreat. I'm doing the bridge retreat in November. Mm-hmm. And I'm really looking forward to that, because again, it's another layer of my healing that I'm ready to explore now. And I think on my to-do list, I am putting, I'm going to do a TEDx talk next year. So I need to, now that I've said it, I've got to do it now, don't I? But I think, you know, my journey has been so great. I mean, more recently, just to take a step back, I was interviewed, a journalist contacted me, Vicky Allen, in July, August this year. She had come across my blog, somebody had recommended, so she was writing a book with another lady, Kay Adams, and she came across my blog and thought my writing was amazing. I love that. I think if nothing else came of it, a journalist thought my writing was amazing. That was a highlight. But she wanted to interview me. She felt that she really wanted my story to be heard and wanted me to be a part of this book. The book is called Still Hot, and it's about menopause, stories of women, 42 different women talk about menopause and perimenopause. And at that time, I didn't think I was perimenopausal until, again, it shows how much, you know, when we don't talk, we don't know.
Yeah.
And I realized that a lot of the symptoms, even my periods getting worse, you know, not being able to lose weight, so many experiences that I'm having around my body that I thought, that I heard people say, oh, it's like that when you're in your 40s, even memory loss, because I never use, if I don't write it down, it ain't happening. You know, I've become very forgetful. But for me, it was like, that happened in my 40s. And now I realize it's because I'm perimenopausal. So I got to understand a new experience with my body that I didn't realize before. And yeah, I was interviewed for the book, which came out this week. Okay. It's available on Amazon. It's called Still Hot. Yeah, and authors are Kay Adams and Vicky Allen. Nice. Yeah, World Menopause Day in the UK is on Sunday, the 18th of October.
Okay.
So it's come out in time for that. So that has been a real, and there's a lot of high-profile women, Angie Grease being one of them, who we would have grown up with on Choice FM in our 20s. Yes, and there's, you know, a lot of high-profile influential women in the book. And I'm like, I'm one of them! I'm telling you, the great thing about it is I now get to tell people it's official, I'm still hot. I think they're going to get a bit frustrated with me soon. But
that is funny. And Yvonne, where can people find you?
So they can find me via my blog, Finding My Plan B. I'm on Facebook under Dreaming of a Life Unlived, and on Instagram as Yvonne. So Yvonne with Y dot Von J.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. Or just Google me. Google Yvonne John, still hot.
I'm definitely going to do that. So Yvonne, it has been an absolute pleasure sharing with you and speaking to you today. And I'm just looking forward for the TEDx.
Yes.
And whatever ideas are
flowing. So.
Yes. And whatever else is going to come for Yvonne John, I'm just so looking forward to it. And I'm just so grateful that you are a voice out there for women of color, that they can see you, see your example, and it will help them on their journey to healing and realizing that you, although you may be childless by choice, you can still get the joy back in your life.
Yes. Yes.
Great.
Thank you so much for reaching out and asking me to be on your platform. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's been an absolute pleasure. Yvonne, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Thank you for spending time with us. We're already looking forward to the next episode of This is Conversations with Allison J. The journey to here. Until next time, honor, respect, and blessings to you all. If you want to connect, visit AllisonJ.net. That's AllisonJaye.net. Allison with one L, as she is the one and only